This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Eric Blem to the show. He is the author of 9 books, and I believe 4 of them are bestsellers on the New York Times and Wall Street Journal list. He's the New York Times bestselling author of Fearless, The Undaunted Courage and Ultimate Sacrifice of Navy SEAL Team 6 Operator Adam Brown, and The Only Thing Worth Dying For, How 11 Green Berets Fought for a New Afghanistan, and author of the new book, Legend, A Harrowing Story from the Vietnam War of one of Green Beret's heroic mission to rescue a special forces team caught behind enemy lines. As I mentioned earlier, he's got 9 books, so we're going to kind of talk about all of his work and whatever specifically Eric wants to kind of focus on. Eric, welcome. How are you?
Jason, thanks for having me on the show.
It's good to have you, and you're coming to us from San Diego, is that correct?
San Diego, North County, a little town called Cardiff by the Sea.
Oh, I know it well. It's a charming place. I don't know which book we should really talk about first. You've got such a big body of work, but maybe I'll let you make that decision.
With the angle of your show, the last season was the story of backcountry Park Service Ranger Randy Morganson. And he was a guy who was known for being the go-to person, the wise man of the woods. One of his Park Service fellow rangers called him the Obi-Wan Kenobi of the backcountry. When someone went missing in this vast wilderness that he patrolled, he was the first person they'd go to. And then one day he went missing himself. And that's kind of the topic of the story. It's the search and rescue operation to find Randy Morganson, as well as his life story. He grew up in Yosemite. He used to carry around Ansel Adams' tripod as a kid. Wallace Stegner, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, would critique his journals and his diary entries when he was a kid. And ultimately, he devoted his life to protecting the people from the park and the park from the people as a backcountry ranger. He'd be helicoptered in for an entire season with enough food for a whole summer season. And then he'd patrol roughly 20 miles on the John Muir Trail. That was what he did.
Fantastic. Well, before you tell about his story, and I'm dying to know if he was ever found, did you cover and chronicle stories of some of the people he rescued and how they survived?
I did, and there's success stories, and there were stories where the mountains, Mother Nature took the upper hand and people were killed, and this is part of the reality of wilderness. One story in particular that was very telling was a young man had a climbing partner on the Devil's Crags, and he was climbing, and there was a landslide, and all of a sudden, this one guy had to take it upon himself to make the decision, do I leave my buddy who was very seriously wounded to go get help, or do I stay here with him? They were so far back there that he knew that if he stayed with him, he would perish himself. So he gave his buddy all the warmth that they had. He gave him his jacket, an extra sleeping bag, and then he took off cross country and ultimately stumbled upon none other than Randy Morganson in his cabin. And they turned around and they had to wait overnight because they knew that they could not find him in the dark, and they went the next morning to find this guy. And as you can imagine, the anxiety of this young man who had left his best friend, who was very gravely injured, they came back and unfortunately he had passed away. But Randy worked with this kid and kind of he gave him the holistic, as your show is, approach to looking at the wilderness and how this guy had died doing what he loved. And he applauded this young man because there could be 2 body bags coming out of the wilderness instead of just 1. And he did everything right. He gave away some of his own survival gear for his friend, but he did everything right. He followed water. He went back to the cabin where he had remembered a ranger cabin earlier. He did all the things that were correct. And because of that, instead of 2, there was just 1 casualty that day in the High Sierra.
Wow, yeah, amazing. It's just amazing how powerful nature is and some of the things that people do to try and overcome it and the heroic things they do to save others. It's just incredible, it really is. Do you want to kind of switch gears and talk about, you know, some of the military stories? I mean, there's some amazing survival stories there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Fearless is the story of Adam Brown, and he was a Arkansas boy who grew up, he was an athlete, great kid, kind of would open doors for men and women alike, say sir and ma'am and please and thank you. But in college, he tried crack cocaine one night, and it rocked his world. It turned his world around. He came into a self-professed dirtbag, drug addict, criminal, stealing from his own family. His family eventually took the tough love approach, had him arrested, and he was, through waivers, given the opportunity to try and turn his life around, and he joined the Navy. And he rose to the very top tier of Navy SEAL Team 6 after overcoming grievous wounds in the military. He had his right eye shot out at one point in a training accident, and then he had the fingers on his right hand crushed off when his Humvee rolled. He was holding the edge of the window like you do when you're driving sometimes. Well, it rolled. His fingers were crushed off. He came back. He could have retired with a medical discharge honorably, but he said, I am not done yet. He taught himself to shoot left-handed and to do everything, left-handed and non-dominant eye, one eye, not no peripheral vision, and still qualified at that top-tier level. And these guys, their survival skills are, you know, they're add survival with the wilderness, plus you're getting shot at. And this is what this guy was able to overcome, is just digging deep into that inner self that says, you know, I will not only survive, but I will overcome anything that comes my way. And his story is just, he's a hero in the SEAL community. And one of the guys that even he looked up to and the SEALs look up to is Roy P. Benavidez, the Special Forces Green Beret, who's a topic of legend. My new book, who he, in 1968, the year I was born, I didn't know a lot about Vietnam. They didn't have a lot in the school books. And I, after 9/11, I actually dedicated my life to telling the stories of these guys who serve, especially in the special operations community. And Roy was a guy who was at a base in South Vietnam, and he heard a distress call from Cambodia of a special forces team that was surrounded by hundreds, if not thousands, of North Vietnamese Army soldiers. They were stacking the bodies of their dead as cover. And Roy heard this distress call, and he went to a helicopter that landed that was bound for that combat zone to try and get these guys out. All he had on him, the guys that go into these reconnaissance missions, they're carrying all sorts of their survival gear, ammo, grenades, claymore mines, you name it, anything that they can do to evade the enemy and live in that jungle environment for days if need be. Well, Roy jumped in this helicopter, and he had been on his way to the mess hall for breakfast. All he had in his pocket was a bottle of Tabasco sauce, and he had an 8-inch Special Forces knife. He grabbed a medical bag.
Well, let me ask the important question here. Why did he steal the Tabasco sauce?
He didn't steal it. He kept it with him always. He always had it. I mean, the food is not known for the cuisine in a military mess hall. So he always, he's from Texas boy. He kept a bottle of Tabasco sauce with him always. And he was on his way to the mess hall. That was just his standard operating procedure. Whatever they got in there, it can be improved with Tabasco sauce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, absolutely. Okay, so did he use the Tabasco sauce?
It is just a funny thing that has come up over the time where, you know, of all things to bring into battle, a bottle of Tabasco sauce. It was said that at one point earlier in his career that they were had captured a Viet Cong soldier and they were questioning him. And at one point they had the little bottle out and they said, he kind of threatened this guy with, you're going to eat some of this stuff and then you're going to talk. And so that was just, I think that's more of his own little legend that he brought up himself, but no,
that's a pretty good story though. Actually, you know, that's a good use for it, right? You could torture the guy with Tabasco sauce to make him talk.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, you know, in today's day and age of torture being such a, I'm leery of going there, but yeah, you know what? Tabasco sauce for somebody who's never tried it, I can't think of a better torture person.
It might be better than waterboarding. Who knows?
Exactly. Exactly. So he flew in to this landing zone and the fire was so intense, they could not get him close enough to this small team that was in a small clearing. There was a stand of trees and an anthill in the middle of a clearing that was surrounded by jungle. It's that hot, humid Cambodian tropical climate, and they can't get him in. The helicopters are saying, we're getting too shot up. And he said, get me as close as you can. And as he is about ready to pull out the helicopter pilot, a guy named Larry McKibben, 20-year-old pilot. He said, "I can't get you in." And Roy said, "Get me as close as you can." He got about 100 yards away, hovered about 15 feet off the deck, and Roy jumped out of the helicopter into this clearing that was just being lit up with tracers and bullets and explosions. A guy that was flying overhead in a gunship that was providing close air support said at that moment, "They're shooting him out of the helicopters." He thought there is no way that this person just jumped willingly 15 feet into this battle. He thought that he had been shot out of the helicopter. But in fact, it was Roy, and he landed, he tumbled, he took off running, immediately got tripped up. He thought a thorn had snagged his leg. What he didn't know is that he'd actually been shot through the leg. But he kept going with on adrenaline, got a little closer, rocket-propelled grenade almost took him out, but he took shrapnel. He ended up going almost 100 yards through enemy lines and enemy fire, made it into this decimated perimeter of this small special forces team that, you know, they were suffering blood loss. One guy had a missing limb and a tourniquet. They were on the verge, just by necessity of not giving up, of just ready to die. And then the people were telling me in the interviews, "We were ready. I was ready." One in particular, "I was ready to die." And Roy then came in and gave them that will to fight and to live. And again, it's a testament of that human spirit, the capabilities of what you can do when all is lost. If you can dig deep and you have the right mindset, they say your heart, it's the size of the heart, not the man, that will prevail. And in that case, as in all cases of survival, those are the people who do prevail and do survive and do walk away from these situations that would normally take a person's life.
It's amazing how powerful the mind and the mindset are in this kind of stuff. I mean, of course, Viktor Frankl famously wrote about it in Man's Search for Meaning. It's important to have a reason to live, you know? That's what it's for. You know, there's got to be some kind of mission, some kind of thing that just makes you pull through against all odds, right?
Exactly. I mean, Roy's life kind of set him up for that mission. He was orphaned at age 7. His dad died when he was 3 of tuberculosis. His mother died of tuberculosis when he was 7 in the rural southern part of Texas. He was adopted by an uncle who had 8 kids, and he spent his early years getting taken out of school early and then coming to school late after the summer by picking sugar beets and cotton. The sharecropper and poverty, prejudice. He was grew up in that era in the 1930s and early 40s when he'd go to a movie theater and pay 9 cents for a movie ticket. And then the ushers would point at a sign that says, and I quote the sign, "Negroes and Mexicans to the balcony." That was the era he grew up in. And he could have really gone any route in life, but if it weren't for the forward thinking wisdom of his uncle, Uncle Nicholas, who said, "You know, this is the country's growing pains, and you don't have to respond to a racial slur with a punch in the nose, that there is honor and restraint, and you need to dig deep and you need to find that meaning and honor our name, honor the family name, and remember, you're Mexican American, but you're American." And that is became ultimately Roy's mission when he joined the military. He wanted to serve his country, and it was his love of God, country, and family that really drove him throughout that career. And I think it's what took him and brought him through that day, 1968, May 2nd.
Amazing stuff. What other amazing tales did you chronicle in any of your books? I mean, with so many books, it's just amazing the body of work. It's been a lot to chronicle in all of these stories, right?
A book I wrote called The Only Thing Worth Dying For was the story of, again, the Special Forces story of Green Berets right after 9/11. And they infiltrated the Taliban-held South. And they went in, as a lot of us have heard about the horse soldiers and the guys that went in and teamed up with the Northern Alliance, which was a standing military in Afghanistan. Well, this team in particular, ODA 574, Operational Detachment A Team, ODA 574, they went into southern Afghanistan, which was held by the Taliban. There was no Southern Alliance. And they went in with a little-known statesman named Hamid Karzai, who ultimately became, as we know, the president of Afghanistan.
Sure.
And these guys went in to an area where they studied the area. This is a perfect example of that classic thing in wilderness where people say the country is not the map. You know, when you're on the ground, things change. And they were inserted into an area. They had planned all of their potential evasion techniques and defense and everything upon landing and being inserted into a certain village. Well, when they got on the ground and they made their way to the village from where the helicopters had let them off and they had their GPS, I mean, they woke up in the morning and they realized they were not where they thought they were. And everything changed. And that happens in wilderness, happens everywhere. the map is not the country. And when you're on the ground, whether it's a military situation or not, you have to adapt. And that's what these guys did. They adapted, they retread everything on the fly to figure out what are they going to do to foment a rebellion among these villagers. And that was their job, to foment a rebellion among the Taliban and have them rise up against the Taliban in that area. Well, since they were on the ground, they turned around and they found out that the local villagers had risen up against their Taliban leaders because they thought, hey, the Americans are on the ground now, we're going to be fine. And then a retribution force came from Kandahar out to put down this uprising in a village. And these 12 men had a choice to make. They could either abort the mission and get the heck out of there, or they could stay and meet the enemy. And they knew if they didn't, that these villagers would have been slaughtered by this retribution force on the way. They took the stance of, we're going to stand and we're going to fight this large group of what they estimated at least 500 fighters coming their way in Toyota pickup trucks and with some armor. And they did, and they called in close air support, and they rescued a village in a place where they were not prepared to be there. It's when, as they often say, the battle plans change the minute the first bullet's fired. That can change in any wilderness trip as well. You know, a landslide, a rock chips off and you fall, you know, 15 feet and you have a compound fracture, whatever it might be, all of a sudden you have to reevaluate everything and take a look and make those decisions to go forward.
Amazing story. Why is it that you think, you know, in your coverage of all of these different military heroes and telling their stories, why is it that, like, you tell this story of, you know, this village being basically saved by our guys? Why is there so much hatred and animosity toward America around the world? Or is there? Is that real? I mean, you know, Obama likes to say it is. I don't know that he's helped the situation at all.
There are generalities, and whatever gets reported on, especially in Vietnam, you know, you talk to the guys who were there and they will say it was a very different experience than what they read about in the newspapers back home later. The people who I've spoken with, there's a lot of people out there that they love America. And, you know, you don't see all the good that's been done, not only in building schools and, you know, infrastructure for the country. You can't say that the Taliban, women were relegated to staying in the basement and hiding if they were going to read or study anything. They couldn't fly kites. Kids could not partake in athletic sports. I mean, come on. Who is going to truly say, yes, this is a better place for these people and that they...
Well, I can actually answer that question for you. Western liberals, especially Western female liberals, seem to think that's a better place, amazingly. People who ostensibly say they support gay rights and they support women's rights. Here you have the most oppressive, we'll call it ideology, in the world against that. I just have no idea how they can rationalize that. I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, there you go. There's a lot of contradiction in beliefs and in our country as well. And if you sit back and you look at it, I mean, Roy Benavidez and his people would say, oh, the South Vietnamese, they were not being treated poorly by the communists when they were there. Well, he went into a village and found an elder sitting at the foot of a young child who had been hammered to the wall of a hut.
Oh, disgusting.
For target practice. And he was catching the blood from this child's toes and weeping and wailing with the mother beside him. And this was because they did not send their young men to fight with the communists who were coming in to basically force the people to fight for their one struggle. And I'm sorry, that's not our standard operating procedure in America, yet it is printed. There is a whole printed plan for what their plan was for taking over and unifying, as they called it, South Vietnam and North Vietnam. And part of that was exactly this type of torture. We don't have that in our standard operating procedure in our military, and you can't find it anywhere. Yeah, there's always things that go wrong in war and there are bad apples, but it is not in our doctrine, and it was in theirs. And I know which side I'd like to be on.
Yeah, well, couldn't agree with you more. But, you know, you talk to a Western liberal and they just overtly want to see socialism come back, and socialism is one step away from communism. We all know how that works out. So, you know, literally, this ideology is responsible for the deaths of well over 200 million people. You just take Stalin, you take Hitler, because that was the National Socialist Party nobody wants to actually remember what the Nazi Party was. It was a socialist party, okay? You take Stalin, Hitler, you take Mao, and, you know, a few others, it's 200 million people. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, there's a little word called genocide, and it's not in our doctrine.
But then again, I guess that's good for the environment. You know, because people are the scourge of the earth, right? You know, maybe we're going a little too far afield here, but
it's the same crazy ideology,
right?
You know? Well, it comes around. And I mean, it's always in my books and what I do. I mean, I personally keep my politics out of my books. I try and tell these stories because I do feel that people are innately smart. And they can read
it. They'll figure it out. Yeah,
and if you just tell the story, and what I try and do is I try and tell the story from the perspective of the people who are there, the first person accounts. I avoid hearsay. I avoid what was written about a situation because, goodness, you never know. But I do talk to the people who are actually at these events, and that's what I stick to. And I keep my own personal politics. You know, there's some authors who will tell a story and then they get their own point across. I'm going to tell the perspective of who the guys are in these stories, stay true to their ideology into their mission and their actions. And from that, you get a pretty clear picture of what happened. And that's what I'm proud of. I love to keep the politics out if I can. Yeah. If not, you can still see it through the actions of the characters.
Right.
Story, I call them characters in my books. One father of a son who was killed in Afghanistan, Lou Pettitore, told me Daniel H. Pettitore was killed, the first Special Forces soldier killed in Afghanistan. When I left after staying at his house for 3 days, sleeping in Dan's bedroom, playing on the trails where he did as a kid, eating his favorite breakfast his mom cooked for me. He told me at the end, "Eric, you've spent 3 days getting to know who Dan was from the day we brought him home from the hospital to the day that we were informed of his death at the same door when the honor guard knocked with that horrible, menacing knock that so many have heard." Yep. And he said, "I know you're going to do a great job. Just tell it to the people like it happened. Talk to his buddies who were there. Tell it to them straight." And that's what I try and do.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk a little bit about how you do that research and how much time does it take to do one of your books when you've got to try and find firsthand accounts of things that happened, you know, decades ago. That's got to be pretty challenging.
It's very challenging, and add to that the fog of war, and it gets all the more foggy.
Right.
But the last season, I was still, you know, I was doing other things for work at the time, so I wouldn't call it a full-time job. I spent 7 years researching the last season. I spent more than 50 days in the backcountry finding places where exact rocks where Randy had sat and wrote a section in his diary. I had access to all of his diaries and his personal notes. I retraced the steps of the search and rescue operation. With the only thing worth dying for, I spoke to as many eyewitnesses and survivors as I could and all the family members of those who were killed. And from that, you get a perspective of who these people are. The only thing worth dying for was about 3.5 years, start to finish. Fearless was about one individual, and it was less. It took about a year. There was if there's a higher power, it was powering me through that book because that was an extremely fast book to write with 1 year. And then this book on the Vietnam era, it was 2 solid years full time. And towards the end, you know, when you get behind the eight ball with the deadline, we're talking 15, 16 hour days for many months in order to stay true to the story and to be accurate and to really honor history and honor the men and in some cases women who serve. You got to dig deep. And I try and go narrow and deep versus far and broad. And at the end of the day, especially in legend, you get a great microcosm look at the Vietnam War as a whole, all wrapped up in this one battle where these various characters come together from different aspects, the air and the ground, the 240th Assault Helicopter Company, and Roy Benavidez, this former orphan sharecropper from Texas, who all came together and bonded and banded together like brothers to rescue these men who were surrounded, and they would have perished had they not answered the call.
Yeah, yeah. Have you thought about doing a book, or have you done any books or stories on Benghazi?
There's been a couple that have been out there already. Did have an interest in Benghazi. And, you know, when I go to tell a story, I like to talk to the family members. And if they want the story told, great. But I'm not a high-pressure salesman. If they don't want to go there, I'm not going to push it. And some of the family members of those who fell were behind their own books that they were writing, and some other journalists were going forward. And it was just too close to that period of time. So at some point, you know, I have an interest in it. I probably won't be the one to write it because I'm booked up with stories for a few years right now. And I know there's some that are in the works, but I do know there is one or two books out there, Soft Rep Radio, and the Soft Rep has actually a very short account that I think is like an ebook available, but there's another one that, as well, that's come out recently, and I think that that story will be fleshed out for the next couple of years.
Give out your website if you would, Eric.
It is ericblehm.com, ericblehm.com, and I'm on Facebook/Eric Blehm and Twitter, all that, all the social media, all that stuff that we do to get the word out. If you go on YouTube, there's actually a couple of really nice book trailers, like movie previews for Fearless and also for Legend. So if you look up Legend or Fearless on YouTube, they're really nicely done trailers that we put together. And I'd encourage anybody that wants a snapshot of those two books in particular, or The Only Thing Worth Dying For, there's one for that as well. That's a quick and easy way to get a 2-minute look, just like you do for a movie preview.
Excellent. Good stuff. Eric, I just want to ask you to give any closing thoughts you have on whether it be parts of the stories you've covered or survival tips or whatever. It's all yours.
Every story, I learned something. The last season, I learned to slow down and take a look around once in a while. And that can be good for any part of your life or while you're in the wilderness. For The Only Thing Worth Dying For, I learned do the right thing, even when no one's watching. And for Roy Benavidez, never give up. It's that classic line, but never give up. Don't give in to that dark side that tells you, I can't get through this, because you can.
Yeah, excellent advice. Eric Blehm, thank you so much for joining us.
Jason, I appreciate being on your show. And to anybody in your listenership who serve or families who serve, thank you for your service.
Thank you for joining us today for the Holistic Survival Show, protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Be sure to listen to our Creating Wealth show, which focuses on exploiting the financial and wealth creation opportunities in today's economy. Learn more at www.jasonhartman.com or search Jason Hartman on iTunes. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, offering very general guidelines and information. Opinions of guests are their own, and none of the content should be considered individual advice. If you require personalized advice, please consult an appropriate professional. Information deemed reliable, but not guaranteed. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.